Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
A quick look at the front pages. First, the Chuckle Brothers are on all the front pages. Keir Starmer and Simon Harris, The Great Reset. So they're there, game for a laugh, on the front of the Sunday Times. And the front Sunday Times headline is Vulture Funds to Pay Twice Stamp Duty on Homes. So Neil Richmond of Fine Gael is now saying that new homes bought by Vulture Funds should pay 20% stamp duty. The Sunday Independent: property prices on track for 10% surge this year, and that'll be very dismaying news to so many younger people. There's a little story there as well, and this will go down well now with parents after the last few weeks. They're trying to think of various ways to give us our own money back, I think, and they come up in new ingenious ways every day in budget promises. A new tax credit, Philip Ryan says, to help parents with the cost of sports, art and cultural activities is being considered at budget negotiations formally begin this week. The Irish Mail on Sunday is leading with FF launch fight back to claim credit for budget. Apparently their fight back, a lot of it seems to centre around adding on 10 grand to the living above the shop tax rebate from, I think, is it up to 50 or 70, I think, for a derelict building. I don't know that that's a huge plank of a fight back. The Business Post: Harris and Starmer hurled new dawn for Anglo-Irish relations, 120 billion trade and business relationship a key priority. The Mirror has a very sad story. The actor Brian Murray, who, as you know, is living with Alzheimer's, and his partner Una Crawford says it is progressing rapidly now and he often forgets who she is. And that is a story being played out in families all over the country, and desperately sad. And the Irish Sun on Sunday: Amanda rage at BBC over Giovanni. And that's Amanda Abingdon, who's in a rage with BBC bosses over fears that the Giovanni Pernice bullying probe will be a whitewash. I wish they would just come out with the report and end this now. It's driving me crazy. I need to know the result at this stage. And the Sunday World: bad blood, gun thug says he's all good after horror stabbing. This is out of a gang feud in Cork, and a criminal called Gavin Sheehan in broad daylight attack with a knife, but he says he is fine. Now, our panel this morning: Fergus Finlay is a columnist with the Irish Examiner, a former advisor to the Labour Party and former head of Bernardo's as well, Fergus. Alice Leahy is a homelessness campaigner. Donegal Bacon is professor of politics in DCU. And Brenda Power is a columnist with the Sunday Times and the Irish Daily Mail. Good morning, everybody. Good
morning, Brendan.
Fergus, people will have heard you on Liveline earlier in the week talking about the latest wave, I suppose, of child abuse allegations in this country. And I would say my standout listening to you was that you are furious, bottom line. So a few days now to reflect and to kind of process things a bit more. It feels to me like people are getting angrier by the day, as against the anger dissipating here.
Yeah, I know I am. I mean, when I was on that programme, I hadn't had time to do more than glance at the coverage of the scoping report. I hadn't gone into it in detail. I spent the last few days trying to read it. Now, it's not an easy narrative. I mean, there's an awful lot of facts and figures and tables and so on. There isn't a human story in it, though such human story as there is told empathetically. But the fact,
the insights that we get from the interviews with these guys mainly, they are horrific.
They're appalling and wounding, and you feel kind of crawling with shame when you read what some of these people went through. But what I hadn't realised when I was on the programme was the extent to which so much of this alleged abuse happened to children who have no way of defending themselves in special schools and in settings where, you know, for people with intellectual disability who don't have a voice, who can't tell their parents, who can't go to the guards, who can never be part of a prosecution because they can't be allowed to give evidence. So I mean, like, it's disgrace piled upon disgrace. It's for victims, it's trauma piled upon trauma. For organisations, the organisations at the heart of it They just don't care, Brendan. It's about corporate reputation. It's about assets. It's about money. These are immensely rich organisations. I looked up the Holy Ghost Fathers in the Charities Register, and they've declared assets of 150 Spiritans million. Spiritans now, Holy Ghost Fathers then. I tend to think of the term Spiritans as a bit like changing Windscale to Sellafield, but there you are.
Okay. In statements this week, various orders have said they do care.
Yes, I'm sure they do care, but they care primarily about their own reputations and about their assets. And there is no intention, not a single one of them so far. Not a single CEO has offered a resignation. Not a single head of an order has offered to make a substantial contribution to redress. None of them. They care and they want to consult and they want to be involved in counselling and so on. But don't touch our money, please.
Brenda.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the fact that since 2002, these organisations, these religious institutions have undertaken to pay 480 million in compensation to victims. And so far, only 245 million has been paid. And it is clear.
And the state paid $1.25 million.
$1.25 billion,
I beg your pardon, of that redress.
And indemnified the orders.
It's clear they're going to fight tooth and nail. And I saw a suggestion of somebody yesterday to the extent that one course of action that might force them to the negotiation table and might force them to open their checkbooks would be to review the statute of limitations in respect of these allegations, as they did in 2000 after the Suffer the Little Children documentary emerged. They extended, they allowed, because there's a two-year statute of limitations on a personal injury claim, allow them to make a claim within a year of that revision. Because so go down the civil route. And if all of these claims come, that suddenly they might find they may be in a position to crunch the numbers and realise that if we are faced with 2,500 people bringing civil actions against us, maybe the best way
the
to
two
do
and a half
it
thousand
is,
and the rest.
I know, but that
and,
today.
Jim O'Callaghan seemed to be saying the other day that he doesn't feel, as it stands right now, that the government can force the orders to hand over money for a redress scheme. And he's admitting it's less than ideal. But what he's saying is that the way it could work is if a raft of court cases start coming. And
exactly
that way it could happen. Yeah. But Fergus, you wanted to come back in there. I'll come to the others now.
It's placing the onus on the victims, though, isn't it? I mean, I'm totally in favour of them being sued. Absolutely in favour of it. But it is placing the onus on the victims. It apparently isn't practicable in Ireland for class actions to be undertaken. In the States, this would be the subject of a major class action. And it would be run on a no-fold, no-fee basis by major firms of lawyers. In Ireland, that doesn't appear to be possible. People have to, if you want to sue a religious order in Ireland, the first thing you have to do is put your house, your own house, on the hazard. Because if you lose, you will lose everything. And that's not
okay,
fair.
And the experience is that they will fight in the most adversarial manner, tooth and nail, or until they don't.
Well, if you look at the experience of the Louise O'Keefe case, which of course was the state fighting, they didn't just fight Louise O'Keefe every step of the way. And she was abused by a state-employed, state-paid, state-pensioned teacher. They fought her every step of the way. She ended up having to go to the European Court and at risk of everything. And when they won at the Supreme Court, they wrote to every other outstanding claimant saying, we'll come after you too if you take us on. So if the state will do that, so will the religious orders.
Alice, in common with Brenda and Donica, you picked Gary Murphy's piece in the Sunday Times. Abusers' names were widely known, yet no one dared speak. And it does give us a kind of an insight into the times as well.
It does. And I think what it also does, when I read his article, his father was an apprentice painter in the building. So it captured the bleakness.
Which in building Cork. Was that? Yeah, in the...
Colin.
Yeah, Gary mentions three places. The so-called Red Brick,
which was up on
a hill overlooking Cork, haunting the city. Lota,
Special School.
And then Bessborough as well. I think his father was painted in Bessborough.
I think he captured the physical building and the bleakness of it and the horror of it almost. And I think in a way we are talking about protecting the institutions and money. But I think we even have to look far deeper than that. The effect this has had on generations of people who have suffered that pain, and people are still suffering the pain of having lived in those institutions. And in some ways, I think Colin Murphy's piece on The Independent yeah. opens up the debate a bit more, and yeah. he highlights the vision of the Spiritans. I mean, we all hear yeah. about mission statements and all of that, an option for the poor. I've heard so much of that over the years, and private schools. And I do think if parents work hard to send their students, their family to private schools, that's right. But there has always been a huge sense of power in that cohort of people. And yet these are educated people, and they have been afraid to speak out, and probably yeah, out yeah. of loyalty to their parents, many of them who
and
struggled.
And he mentions lads whose parents had struggled
he
very
did.
Hard to get them there, and they didn't want to let their parents down.
They didn't want to offend yeah. them. And he also yeah. mentioned meeting.
It's a good point you make, Alice.
And I think it's an excellent article to yeah. open up the debate.
It's a good point you make about, and it's maybe, I think it was there in the initial conversation around BlackRock. But it's just interesting. It's probably by the by in a way. But that, like, particularly, I think those of us who didn't go to those schools, and Fergus, you might identify with this a bit, that we tend to have a chip on our shoulder about those kind of schools and those kind of guys and the confidence they often have and the network and everything else. And we thought these guys were the masters of the universe, and it turns out the whole thing was rotten to the core.
Yeah, I didn't go to BlackRock College. I did go to Presbrey. My daughters went to Sion Hill, which is beside BlackRock College, and they would all tell you about the times they were sneered at and mocked and so on because their families couldn't afford BlackRock College. There was a certain arrogance about the kids. But when you discovered that behind the scenes there yeah. were kids living in fear and terror themselves.
But mustn't we then be careful that we allow those people to express how they feel now?
Yeah. Oh,
because
yeah.
they are 100%. Struggling now maybe to admit what they saw, but were fearful at the time. So we mustn't add to the gift.
Absolutely. The only point I'm making is that, you know, they seemed like these edifices yeah. creating yeah. masters of yeah. the universe. John Charles McQuaid's yeah. very, you know, place itself. To educate the cream of the country who go on to lead the country and this is what
and
was happening
right,
there.
But also I think there was a perception when these allegations first began to emerge maybe 20 years ago that they focused on children from lower sort of socioeconomic backgrounds, that they were more vulnerable, that they were easier to abuse and they were easier to access. And we now see that they were basically equal opportunities. Yeah. Abusers.
The principal reason kids were sent to industrial schools back in the day was poverty. That was the principal reason. They were not criminals. They were not kids who had committed crime. They were sometimes sent because their mothers, you know, were regarded as being of ill repute or their fathers couldn't look after them. They were poor kids and treated accordingly, abused accordingly and disrespected accordingly.
Okay, guys, if you put on your headphones there, and we'll go back to what Fergus was talking about initially about the abuse of children in institutions for kids with intellectual disabilities and other disabilities, because we're joined now on the line by Dr. Margaret Kennedy. And Margaret is a longtime campaigner, both for the victims of clerical abuse and the rights of disabled people. Good morning, Margaret.
Good morning.
And Margaret, you are also a survivor of clerical abuse yourself. You're an expert on the abuse of children with disabilities. You were, in fact, a whistleblower in this area back in 2003, and your work at that time exposed abuse of children with learning disabilities in a special school. The scale of abuse of children in special schools revealed in this report is, as Fergus was saying, it's shocking. Are you surprised?
No. And I tell you why, because we've always left them behind. We've always left learning disabled people behind, disabled people behind. I mean, I was looking back at the Ryan Commission report and looking at the disability stats there. Ryan, there was 20 deaf girls and 20 deaf boys interviewed for Ryan, and they only got 20 lines allocated to their cases. Another deaf school, there was one page had two photographs and it ended up with one page for the abuse survivors. We have always minimized, or because we don't know how to discuss it, we don't know how to deal with it, we don't know how to get the information out of people who do not use English as their first language. And it's still the case that we find it too hard to do and we say how we can't do it. Well, it can be done. It just needs effort, time and skill.
So when a child who is abused has a disability, does that create a whole other different set of challenges and difficulties in finding it and in dealing with it and in even trying to help those people heal?
Absolutely, a whole new layer, because many of disabled people do not say what's happening to them, but they will express it. Challenging behaviour, head banging, biting, aggressive behaviour. We call it challenging behaviour as if it's a discrete disease or condition. Challenging behaviour can be one of the biggest, or one of the indicators that all is not well with this child or adult. And yet we drug them with antipsychotic drugs to keep them quiet. We have to learn how to listen to other than voice, behaviours, signs, pictures, drawings. We have to have very skilled people around.
Margaret, does this report feel like a step forward to you? Are you hopeful?
It's certainly getting more attention, giving more attention to disabled children, deaf children, and learning disabled children. That I really feel this time around, giving more attention. I mean, I'm still gobsmacked that 44 alleged abusers were in St. Mary's School for the Deaf. 44 alleged abusers in one school. It's a hell of a lot of abusers to have on site, maybe not all at one time, but goodness me, this is targeting.
We've no way of knowing this, but do you feel when you see those numbers and you see the numbers for Lota that some of these people were attracted deliberately into those types of institutions because they thought there was easier prey there?
Yes, of course, it's targeting. I had a priest in Northern Ireland who was sent from Northern Ireland to a deaf school in England and abused all the deaf children there. And he had been known abuser in the Isle of Man. So he was a known abuser sent to this deaf school in England. What, some of the Brothers of Charity were sent over to Tingwell Hall in Liverpool, where they abused there. So people went from Lota to Galway to Tingwell Hall in Liverpool, and I knew the case there and the solicitors involved. A devastating movement of abusers to vulnerable places where they knew they wouldn't be caught. They knew the children would not be able to tell, and if they did tell, they wouldn't be believed.
Okay. So what would you like to see now? What does justice look like now?
Justice is a funny thing. Some people want their abuser strung up and hung from the nearest tree. Other people don't want that. They just want the person named for them to be vindicated, for them to be believed, and then to know their abuser. I mean, a lot of the names are not given to the victims. Justice is going to be very difficult for disabled children unless we start working on how are we going to get the stories from learning disabled people, from deaf children. How are we going to do it so that we can record what's happening? That will be justice for them and for their parents. Their parents have been pushed from pillar to post and not told what's going on. And I'm very angry for all of them, parents and children alike. We have to have justice, but it might mean something different to those children who are disabled, or in the sense that they might not even understand what the justice is going to be for them. But we know the stats that 50% of deaf children, 50% of learning disabled children have probably been sexually abused in childhood and probably will be sexually abused in childhood. They are very high statistics.
50%.
50%. Okay. It's very high percentage. We are not talking about small numbers here. Our priority, I'm not saying there should be any priorities because I don't believe in priorities, but I do believe in equality. We do not have equality of service provision for disabled children. Mm-hmm. Non-disabled children get the full whack. Well, almost, not quite full whack, because we wouldn't have all the people complaining about what's happening. But they get more than not disabled children and disabled adults. We have to have equality in the service provider, and the government have got to state that we will no longer let the religious orders who look after learning disabled and deaf children away with this. We have to screech from the rooftops. The newspapers have to start talking about what's happening to disabled children. The newspaper articles are putting a phone line at the end of every article. If you have trouble or difficulties and want to speak about this, here is the phone line. how many learning disabled people, how many deaf people are going to be able to pick up the phone? Mm-hmm. And do the people at the end of the phone understand how they're going to deal with this? It's a big, big issue. I wish them luck, because it's a hard line. It's a hard road to take. I took it for nearly 30 years, and I fought and fought and fought, and I'm very pleased of what we did in 2003.
Okay, Margaret, and you've fought the long fight and the good fight, and I'm sure everyone thanks you for your service, and thank you for that very stark intervention this morning, Dr. Margaret Kennedy. Thank you. I'll come back to the panel. Donegha, we haven't heard from you yet. The piece you picked was Maeve Sheehan in the Sunday Independent, What Became of Previous Inquiry into Alleged Priest Paedophile Ring, and I think it has become very clear, hasn't it, this week, that there were paedophile rings operating.
That's it. And yet, you know, there seems to be a lack of ability to, you know, arrest people. You know, there's no mass arrests. I mean, this is ultimately a criminal conspiracy, because it's, you know, you have the endemic abuse of children. You have coordinated cover-ups. That's quite clear as well. You have, you know, transfers of troublesome priests, paedophile priests. You have the avoidance, as Fergus was saying, of compensating victims, you know, really stonewalling, putting all these obstacles in front of them, you know, because the orders may say they care, but ultimately money talks. And in that case, what it says here is that they don't care. There's a failure to inform police. I mean, if you're aware of a crime taking place and you don't inform, that's a crime. And it seems, if you go back even to...
But listen. This is a long way from not informing the police. Like, you read one of the testimonies here. There were 12 priests present in one person's school. 9 were paedophiles. 3 were involved with me together. I'm sorry if this is upsetting for people, but 3 were involved with me together on one occasion, and 1 also apart. And another person says that it's hard to believe there was no complicity. The fetish underwear we were made to wear fitted to us as 12-year-olds.
Yeah, and the thing is that this is not unique to Ireland. I just think it's important to put this in perspective. I mean, because the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child did a major investigation in 2014, and, you know, they looked at this. I mean, it's in America, it's in Australia, and what they were clear to say as well is that what happens in Ireland in Catholic congregations when it comes to the abuse of children, they said, you know, the Catholic Church in Ireland and the congregations function under the authority of the Holy See. It's an international organisation with, by the way, lots of assets, because, you know, as Brenda was pointing out, I mean, they haven't paid the amount that they promised to pay. And I don't even see why the state has to go cap in hand saying it's a moral obligation, or they'll reach out to these bodies to see what they can contribute. You know, they have assets, they have money, but they've been holding on to them. And that has again shown a lack of contrition, to use the terminology that's common in these congregations.
Their own terminology.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, the guards now, in fairness, do seem to be stepping up here. They have had 160 contacts from people this week, and they have been very clear that they will work with all those people in a very sensitive manner at the pace that those people want to work at, and to go as far as those people want to go.
But the point, though, that Maeve is making, and I picked that piece as well, is that no cleric has ever been prosecuted for concealing or facilitating child abuse. And as you know, the point's been made again and again, this was a conspiracy. You know, there had to be a paedophile ring in operation. These days, if paedophiles want to contact each other, it's very easy to do on the dark web. Those days, it had to be much more concerted, much more deliberate, much more kind of collegial almost, in that you had groups of people who were obviously speaking to each other. Even the business of sourcing fetish underwear in Ireland in the 1970s. You had to go to a catalogue, you had to go to the post office and get a postal order and write off for this stuff. It wouldn't have been available in Ireland at that time. So the sheer planning and scale, and the fact that so many of these abusers apparently congregated in the same institutions, clearly suggests that there was a ring, and somebody in senior positions knew that this was going on. And as I think it is Colin Murphy, or it might have been Gary Murphy making the point, the boys knew these people's mm-hmm. names. I think Matt Cooper was writing yesterday in the Mail saying we all had a particular nickname for one brother. So how come parents and or at least people in authority didn't know? Of course they knew.
Alice.
It's truly shocking, isn't it, what is coming out? And clearly there had to be paedophile rings. But I suppose something I would be very conscious of, what Margaret Kennedy said, how will history judge us now, this generation, if we're not providing adequate services for poor people, for people who have disabilities? And are we still offloading that responsibility?
Can I ask you, Alice, the kind of people you come across in your work, a lot of them people who are unable to, mm-hmm. unable really would be the word, wouldn't it be, to live in of straight society with the rest of us, a lot with various pain-killing addictions, whether it be alcohol, drugs, whatever. Do you think a lot of them are the outcome of the story we're talking about?
Oh, definitely.
About today?
And I was recently I find this very difficult, actually, because I was recently looking back at photographs of some people we knew. And I never came across, we worked with a lot of women, I never came across any women who complained about the nuns. They actually went back to the nuns, many of them. There were stories, obviously, too, because they were all human beings. But I heard so many people, the men in particular, many were, they were drinking very heavily, their eyes were dull, they weren't able to communicate, they never laughed. And I was thinking of one man the other day.
They never
laughed. Never laughed. And I just saw one photograph, and I can mention his name because the man is long since dead. And he would have been seen a fairly hard man on the streets, drank very heavily. And he sat down with me one day because I would make a point of trying to get people to talk about maybe what was happening, but very mindful that was very painful for people and there weren't the support services around in those days. And I remember Frankie talking to me about Letter Frack and the brothers, and it would be only a throwaway comment. And then he put his hand on my hand and he said, "Well, Nurse Alice, you wouldn't want to know." And I'd say there were lots of people of that generation I've worked with who went to their grave in pain.
Yeah. Dornica, can I ask you politically, how are the government going to handle this now? How should they handle it? Like, it's a mammoth, complex kind of situation that seems to take in, basically. Like, I mean, if it takes in the 3,000 or so schools in the country, this is going to be enormous, isn't it?
No, they have a lot of hard choices to make. I mean, they'll have to decide on a chairperson. It'll most likely be a judge, what rank that will be. But the big questions will be, like, how wide the inquiry will be, how wide will the focus be? And if it's very wide, it's going to be difficult to talk to everybody. And if you don't talk to everybody, some people will feel excluded. How long will it take? I mean, you know, these inquiries often go on for years and justice has already been delayed and denied. But if they go too fast, then people might accuse them of being superficial, not being thorough enough. And then there's the question of redress, and how much, what kind of redress. As was said, it's not only about money, it's about also justice and the abstract sense, seeing people who are responsible, held responsible. How much will religious institutions contribute? And this is a big issue. It goes back to what I was saying about this being not just national, but international. It just came to my mind that both Mary McAleese as President of Ireland and Dermot O'Hearn as Minister for Foreign Affairs related in later years that they were approached during visits to the Holy See.
Yes.
And they were asked, they were said, like, almost like as fellow Catholics, can you not indemnify the Catholic Church from any kind of legal cases that may occur in your country? So the forethought that went into that what's happening in Ireland, perhaps you as an Irish president of Catholic doctrine. So all those things have to be borne in mind as well.
Okay, Fergus, just briefly before we finish off on this, the political system in all its imperfection, is it capable of handling this
if it does it right now?
Yeah,
if it does
yeah,
it right
do what?
From the start. Well, I think the first thing they need to do is appoint a firm of forensic accountants to prepare a report for them on exactly how much money the religious orders have. That's a report for the government. The Scoping Inquiry recommends the establishment of a statutory inquiry. There are two types in Ireland traditionally. There's the tribunal, which operates in public, very slow, extraordinarily expensive. There's the commission, which is quicker but tends to operate in private. But it is possible to have a commission of inquiry which does some of its work in private and some in public. And that's the model we should be using. Side by side with that, we should set up a vehicle which enables everyone, without question, without challenge, to come forward and tell their story in a way that it will be recorded. And whenever a redress scheme is set up, and there will have to be a redress scheme, it must be without conditions. The damage that has been done to survivors of abuse by giving them a few bob and a gagging order at the same time, where they can never tell their story again, is immense. And so all of those things are possible to do, and they're possible to do in a week.
Okay. Okay.
Set up in a week.
I hear you. Okay, and look, again, you can go to rte.ie/helplines if that has kind of upset you and you would like to get some help. And I think it was upsetting for everybody, and I can see looking in the eyes of the panellists here, it's upsetting for them too. So look, upsetting but necessary conversation, and we'll take a break. Fergus Finlay, Alice Leahy, Donegal back on, and Brenda Power staying with us. Welcome back. Fergus Finlay, Alice Leahy, Donegal back on, and Brenda Power are still with us. So Brenda, we have an advance on the bike shed story today in the Sunday Times, page one. Claire Scott, OPW paid for retiring boss's Paris study trips.
Yes.
Put in RTE there instead of OPW. We have a year of political energy.
Well, we might get a year out of this now, because I mean, I do think that the bike shed saga really is a kind of a microcosm of all the lack of accountability and overspend that we have seen in areas that maybe that maybe are a little bit hard to get your head around.
Give me your thesis on that first.
Well, yeah. if I wanted to talk to you about the overspend in the National Children's Hospital. You could convince me that a state-of-the-art ICU unit in a children's hospital could well spiral out of control, and the costs of it could spiral out of control. And we need this fitting, and we need this equipment, and we need this technology.
Okay, so our brain switches off.
A bike shed, Brendan.
Okay.
€336,000 for a bike shed. And I mean, you know, as I was writing about it in the Mail and saying, look, at the very least, we should have expected Oham canticles carved into the Irish granite, or, you know, a sort of Mar-a-Lago style chandeliers from the ceiling. This is not even a bike shed that will keep the rain off the 18 bikes it holds. If there's a bit of wind with the rain, which hardly ever happens in this country.
Sideways rain never happens in Ireland.
In this country. And coming back, I suppose, to what we've been talking about again previously, we don't do accountability in this country very well.
Okay,
we don't do one person responsible for this. But here, this particular story that the Sunday Times has today deals with the chairman of the OPW, who was in charge at the time that this particular scandal happened. There's no other word for it. He apparently was sent on a training course to Paris that cost €35,000 at a time when he was less than a year away from retirement, and asked to explain what the sort of, you know, fiscal wisdom of investing this extent in somebody who was about to retire was. The explanation given is, oh well, that he would be going on to join boards while on a pension, presumably, for his own personal remuneration.
I'll just give the straight version of that.
Okay.
It was envisaged at the time the programme was sanctioned and undertaken by the former chairman that he was likely to have continued involvement in the state sector, potentially on state boards and committees, following the conclusion of his term of office. In such circumstances, the investment in the programme would continue to be of value to the state.
But we were paying to empower him to make more money from the state while still on a pension for expertise that was benefiting him alone financially. And the other question was, could he not have done this course in an Irish college? And the answer given was...
We are seeking clarification. UCD.
We're seeking clarification on this, which is clearly the OPW version of that would be an ecumenical matter. I mean, I really do think that this one is one that needs to be pursued by the media and by politicians. Of course, no politician noticed this thing being built. Nobody saw it there until suddenly the Irish Times revealed its existence last weekend. So nobody queried, well, why do we need a bike shed? There is nowhere in Ireland where your bike is safer from being stolen, I would say, than inside the campus of Leinster House. This is not actually a shed. When I read
Except
about it
by
first...
another TD, perhaps.
But when I read about it first, I thought, OK, they built something fantastically wonderful in granite that will be there for the ages. It's a bike shed. I mean, there have been pictures of comparable bike sheds that cost €5,000 and €6,000 that hold many more bikes. And apparently the OPW built one in Farmley recently enough for 28,000, which sounds ridiculous to me to hold 16 bikes. But at least they were able to explain that they weren't able to build foundations.
Yeah, you see the 28 grand one suddenly sounds like a song, doesn't it?
Steal.
Veronica, you picked that story in the Farmley bike stand, but in general, anyway.
In general, my favourite bit was there was a letter to the Irish Times during the week where it said that a couple earning 60,000 each now can't afford a bike shed in Dublin. they couldn't, if that bike shed had to get...
By the way, I'm being told it's not a bike shed in Farmley, it's just a rack, apparently. So that explains the knockdown prices. Fergus, again, back to your knowledge of the political system in its perfections. John Lee has a piece in the Mail on Sunday. And now, look, it comes with a health warning in that it is unnamed officials. The headline is Hypocritical Politicians Don't Heed Overrun Warnings. Yeah. And this guy is saying some of the same people who condemn such projects have used their office to deliver these projects in the first place. Warnings of cost overruns do not put them off when it comes to political ideology or advantage. He said the firm pressure on officials to execute construction of that bike shed with undue haste and without regard to cost. Does that sound solid?
It sounds completely made up. And not by John Lee, but by whoever talked to him. Completely made up. There are two possibilities here.
Okay.
One possibility is for the OPW to say, we effed up. We're really, really sorry. We made a complete dog's dinner of this. And the person responsible has had their increment docked or is on suspension or is being retrained or fired or something. That's one possibility. The other possibility is to say, bloody politicians, they never heed our warnings. I worked in politics for 30 odd years. I never, ever, ever heard an official say, oh, Minister, if you want it that way, it'll be far more expensive. Never, never. They don't work that way.
So you're saying the OPW people are covering their ass here?
As they covered their ass in respect of the printer last year, do you remember that? As they covered their ass every single time. And that's what the OPW is great at.
But there was
it should be called the CYA.
I'll come back to you.
It should be called the CYA, not the OPW.
Alice, you wanted to come in there.
Well, I would disagree with you. When I woke up, I thought, is this April Fool's Day? Or is this what you come to expect? I can understand, and I hope the officials did mean what they said, and because the hypocrisy is breathtaking. I mean, it is. You saw all the politicians coming out of the woodwork. They're getting huge publicity while we're ignoring a lot of the other issues that are going on. Huge publicity about this bike shed. And
they're incensed.
Oh, they're absolutely incensed. So I don't know what they'll be like if something more serious crops up. I think it is. You would laugh at it if it wasn't just capturing. Brenda captured what I believe as well. I mean, and then they said about Garda stations. I know, reading the papers early in the morning, if you see there's a Garda station open up in Ballydob, the politician who's going for election will be claiming responsibility. It raises very serious questions, I think, about how we see our politicians, how the politicians see themselves, and how we can throw money at things. 336,000, who could buy a house? Incidentally, I wrote a letter to the papers. Now, the good old Lindor did publish it, because in it I said that how can we justify this? But I also pointed out, and I know this is why it wasn't published, because you're meant to stick to the one point.
Just come on.
We wrote to the city councillors, 61 of them, because we've been looking for public showers and toilets in the city of Dublin for 18 years.
How much would they have cost?
5 replied.
Okay, how much would they cost?
Well, I didn't put a cost on it.
I'd say you could do a fair bit of damage for 336.
But it certainly wouldn't cost that much.
Brenda, another one to file under, is it April Fool's Day, is this story that's been bubbling away there all week, and David Quinn is writing about it today. You're writing about it as well. Tell us about the school book.
Yeah, this is extraordinary. This came out earlier in the week, and I have to say, talking about it with colleagues in the media at the time, we said, no, look, we're not going to touch this, because this is clearly an AI-generated hoax. There is no way that an Irish school book for Irish children makes such a mockery, such a heavy-handed, ham-fisted kind of punch worst anti-Irish era mockery of Irish culture, Irish people, Irish beliefs. Basically, you had two families. It's in this SBHE handbook or a textbook for 12 to 13 year olds. And it compared two families. And the children were kind of rhetorically asked, which family would you rather belong to? Family A, they're all portrayed in Bonnie and sweaters. And the kids are doing Irish dancing in the background. The father has a pitchfork and a pair of wellies. There's hens around their feet. And they live in a thatched cottage.
I'm not making this up.
And they don't go on holidays anywhere. They go to the FLA.
Yeah.
They don't stay in Ireland. They go to the FLA and they're not allowed to play any foreign instruments. Or sure, Irish music is great, and they do Irish dancing. They don't follow any sports. They only play hurling and Gaelic football, and they eat bacon and cabbage every single day. Whereas, and then this is the family A, so you could choose them, or else family B, who are clearly a blended family, multicultural family. The mother is they're portrayed as standing outside the Coliseum, but the mother is waving an Anfield, or at least a Liverpool scarf for some reason in Rome, and these people love pizza, curry, and takeaways. Basically, they drive Professor Donal O'Shea would go crazy because this is clearly not healthy food, but it's much better than the homemade, home cooked rubbish that the others eat. They have friends and family all over the world, and they travel and they swap. They do house swaps in Europe, and they meet other families. I was suggesting in the Sunday Times maybe they should do a house swap with family A and really have their eyes opened. Anyway, within a very short time, in fairness, once parents and politicians began to read this absolute tripe, the section was withdrawn. But the question is, like, who thought it was appropriate to mock Irish culture and Irish beliefs and Irishness in this way and peddle this to children as something you should reject?
See, again, Dornoghy, it seems nobody was really responsible. There is a curriculum put out there. They give some resources. The Department of Education, like educational resources, but the books are done by a book company. Department of Education said nothing to do with us, up to the schools to find the suitable books and all that. It's another one of those situations where nobody was in charge.
That's true. I mean, and it is a bizarre example of stereotyping, which you would like to think, you know, you'd hope that it isn't too frequent. But I mean, there are various people in today's newspapers who argue that it's elsewhere in textbooks as well. I'd be more concerned not about school textbooks in terms of, you know, passing on stereotypes and indoctrinating as and this kind of harks back to what we were discussing for the first part of the programme. And that's that, you know, 90% of our schools are still controlled by religious orders. And they obviously are selling a particular faith to a population which is no longer, I think, reflective of that kind of statistic. You know, in 2020, for example, 35% of marriages were Catholic, 42% were civil ceremonies. And then you have a lot of people who just decide not to get married, and they're the ones who are having children of the future, and yet we're locked into this legacy school system which has faith formation at its core.
I don't know that all the parents are freaking out about that. Like, most kids, perfectly normal people I know who might be hugely religious, the kids are making the communion, they're making the confirmation. There's a kind of a cultural acceptance of all of this.
But also, can I say, this ideology is by no means religious based or religious inspired.
Sure.
And this, if you look further through this book, for instance, it says things like sex is assigned at birth. That is just biologically not true. That's just not the case. Children are going to be going into their biology classes and find that your sex is determined at conception. So the children are being told things that are not true.
So this
true
is sex rather than gender.
But it uses the word sex. So they're being sold an ideology that I would say is very much at odds with the religious ideology. So where this is coming from, or who are the people writing this? We need some accountability.
We had two groups got on to us asking us to fill in a questionnaire for school books. Mm. One was a few years ago, another. Then we said, no, this isn't what we do. This isn't what we want. This is what we do. And these are the kind of questions. It wasn't suitable. We said, well, you can't publish it.
In terms of what you wanted to say about
and then
homeless
more recently,
people and
yeah,
that.
More
yeah.
recently then, we had the same thing. And pressure was being put on us, say, well, we have to go to the printer. We have to this. So we said, we don't mind who you have to go to. But this, we do not go along with what you're putting in. So I'm not surprised then that this type of...
Okay.
I mean, it's...
I think we're going to get in trouble here soon. Let's take a break. Fergus Finlay, Alice Leahy, Donegal back on, and Brendan Power staying with us.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Dunica, I would have liked to spend more time on this, but a quick catch up on the foreign situation, and actually we could probably nose it on the chief of the British Secret Service, Richard Moore, was with the CIA boss William Burns in London yesterday, and they were talking about Ukraine, and they were talking about Israel, and saying kind of interesting things.
They were, and I listened to that as it was broadcast live. They focused in on the difficulty in achieving a ceasefire in Gaza, that it's down to the last 10%, but that's the most difficult part. And on Ukraine, they said that there's a strong likelihood that Iran is supplying ballistic missiles to Russia, and that is a major escalation because, of course, Ukraine has been bombarded by ballistic missiles. And it feeds...
These two situations are getting worse and worse, even though we mightn't be fully aware.
And this is the terrible tragedy of it, is that they're getting worse and worse, and yet the attention span of the readers of the newspapers, as evidenced by the paucity of articles that are there. I mean, it was a very eventful week in Ukraine. I mean, Simon Harris, you know, he's known for his energy. I mean, there he was hosting Keir Starmer yesterday, but he was earlier in the week in Kyiv, and it takes a long time to get to Kyiv these days because you've got to take that
train
from Poland. Yeah, I've taken that train. It's gone back and forth. So he was there to pledge Ireland support, and you know, I mean, Ireland has given a lot of support. I mean, Micheál Martin wrote an article earlier this week. I think the figures are, if I have it here, something in the region, 380 million euro we'll have given to Ukraine since February 2022. Now that includes supports for refugees and things like that. And we do obviously do much better than Western European counterparts, not better than Eastern European counterparts in terms of hosting refugees. But, you know, you had an attack on Poltava, 51 people killed in one strike. You had 7 people killed in Lviv. And Lviv is one of those places where people assume is quite safe. It's on the border of Poland. You know, one family completely destroyed. One husband left. His wife and 3 daughters were killed in one attack while they slept. You know, and it doesn't really resonate as much. And you know, we've had the invasion of Russia, bizarrely, by Ukraine as a tactical move. People will question whether that's militarily wise because the Ukrainians are being pushed back on their own territory. And the big thing, they changed, there was a reshuffle of the cabinet in Ukraine. The Minister of Foreign Affairs has gone, he's been replaced, and he had a simple message. He said, we need 3 things in Ukraine. We need weapons, we need weapons, we need weapons. Because they're banging on the door. And as Barry O'Halloran puts it well in an opinion piece on the Sunday Independent, where he says, Harris's key role in securing Ukraine's future inside the EU. What he means by that is that we may not be a military supporter of Ukraine, but we are a major advocate of Ukraine having a speedy entrance into the EU. But he says that, you know, military aid from those who do supply it has always arrived a day late and a dollar short, and it always comes with huge conditions. So the Russians can fire with impunity anywhere in Ukraine. And the Ukrainians know where the missile factories are. They know where the air bases are. They know where these are all coming from. And with the missiles that they get from the Americans, from the Europeans, they're told you can't fire at those because that's firing into Russia.
I guess the Americans have a different calculus, though, on getting involved on the Russian mainland, so to speak, in terms of what the consequences could be. And understandably, Ukraine sees it differently.
Absolutely.
Fergus, speaking of the EU and international relationships and Simon Harris's boundless energy, are you impressed with the reset between Ireland and the UK?
Well, I hope it works, and we need it. I'm not just in relation to the various issues that have been identified, like trade and so on. I think Northern Ireland is in a very delicate situation at the minute. I think politics is semi-moribund in Northern Ireland. I don't understand quite what's going on. I think I said to somebody the other day, if I filled a pub full of political anorexes and nerds and ran a pub quiz, they wouldn't be able to tell me who the Deputy First Minister is. They wouldn't be able to tell me who the Minister for Agriculture is. They wouldn't be able to tell me who the Minister for Finance is. And, you know, I'd have to look all these names up myself. I don't... if there is governance in Northern Ireland, it's weak and it's flimsy. Unionism appears to me to be dying on its feet. Nationalism seems to be strong, but very focused not on Northern Ireland, but on the whole island. And that's fine. They're legitimately entitled to do that. But I really would worry about the state of play. It's only when we all take our eyes off it that trouble starts again.
Okay. I like to end on a light note, Brenda. Can you in 30 seconds, if I was to say to you, 4711.
You remember it, Brenda. I knew you would. Yeah, 4711, do you remember that? The eau de cologne that we all had in our school bags as kids has apparently been discovered by the TikTok generation because it bears a very striking resemblance to a Tom Ford perfume, which costs €343 a bottle.
And how much is 4711? 12
euros.
Okay.
12
right.
euros.
Listen,
let the
rush begin. Okay, that's Kate Lynch in the mail on Sunday.
Woolworths is gone now.
You're getting the chemist now. Mm.
Okay. I think when we get to the point, just bemoaning that Woolworths is gone. Time to call a halt. Fergus Finlay, Alice Leahy, Donegal back on, and Brenda Power, thank you all very much.